"What is that?" Humphrey asked, peering into the dark. The lump of metal the size of a car they were looking at was the front half of a giant metallic foot. Chapter 36. Running Towards Something. Clive tossed out some glowstones that floated up into the darkness, illuminating the huge figure that occupied the interior of the tower. "A giant statue?" Neil postulated.
"Not a statue," Clive said. "There are articulation points on the ankles and knees. I can't see clearly from down here, but likely all the other joints as well. This is some kind of golem, a ridiculously enormous golem."
The air inside the tower was cold and clammy. Jason stepped forward and touched a hand to the chilly metal foot.
"Question mark, question mark, question mark. World engineer. Construct. Diamond rank. Question mark, question mark, question mark. 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 Question mark, question mark, question mark."
Clive quickly followed to see the same message, the others doing the same. All but Sophie, who lacked enhanced magical senses, could sense an incredible but dormant power within.
"What's a world engineer?" Neil asked.
"I have no idea," Clive said.
"I suspect it's best for everyone if none of us ever find out," Neil said. "I don't know about you, but I'm getting a very builder feeling off of this thing."
"You can sense it too?" Jason asked.
"What?" Neil asked. "No, I just meant, you know, world engineer, giant construct. It kind of screams builder, right?"
"I can feel an echo of the builder in this thing's power," Jason said. "This belongs to it."
"Then why did the Order of the Reaper have it?" Humphrey asked.
"Shade?" Jason asked.
"I do not know," Shade said. "The existence of these constructs was unknown to me."
"Seems this place has more secrets than anyone realized," Humphrey said.
"We thought they were just trying to take the astral space," Clive said. "Are these things the true goal?"
"Maybe it's both," Jason said. "The builder wants these back, which is what it'll get if it claims this astral space."
"It doesn't matter what the builder wants," Sophie said. "It doesn't change what we want. We're here to stop the cultists, whatever they're up to."
"Exactly," Humphrey said. "The important part of this discovery is to figure out how it helps us."
"I'm not sure it does," Clive said. "I don't have the resources or, frankly, the knowledge to begin unravelling what this thing is, what it's for, or what it's doing here."
"It at least tells us what to do next, right?" Sophie asked. "Even if we don't know exactly what they're up to, it's going to involve these towers. We already thought that, and this just makes it all the more evident."
"She's right," Humphrey agreed. "Our first move should be to make our way around the outskirts of the city and check out all of these towers. The cultists may well be set up at one of them."
"We can also see if all the towers hold one of these things," Clive said.
"Do we know how many towers there are?" Neil asked.
12, Clive said, "each around 8 kilometers apart."
"All right, Clive, see if you can't seal this thing back up, and we'll leave."
Clive called back to the glowstones he had sent floating up into the tower, and the team left. Once he removed the magical diagram he had used to open it, the doorway closed again, leaving no trace it was ever there.
"I know the original idea was to make our way from tower to tower on foot," Belinda said, "but from the top of these towers we can see some of the others. Should we be portaling or teleporting or whatever?"
Jason was not the only member of the team to unlock a mass transit power with a bronze rank ability. Clive could open a portal, while Humphrey could now teleport people as a group. Their carry capacity and cooldown for each was the same as Jason's gate portal.
"We want to come at each tower as quietly as we can," Humphrey said. "Teleporting into the middle of 8 bronze rankers is a good way to get killed. We should stick with going on foot and have Jason scouted out."
Jason's stealth abilities had become quite formidable by the time all his powers were awakened. His cloak helped him blend into shadows, and he received further boosts from his familiars, Shade and Gordon. For each body subsumed into Jason's shadow, Shade could mask one giveaway element like scent, heat, or even sound, muffling Jason's movements against sensitive ears. While Gordon was subsumed into Jason's aura, Jason's ability to retract it completely was enhanced. Combined with Jason's current aura strength, even most bronze rankers would be unable to sense it. They set out from the tower in the direction of the next. The shoreline was made up of large rocks that were not easily navigable, so they followed the overgrown streets. Even then, the terrain was not easy going. They could have moved faster after all the mobility training they had done, but Humphrey insisted on slow but steady. They were expecting monsters and worse, and he didn't want them stumbling into too much danger at once. Sophie ranged ahead as two of Shade's three bodies watched their flanks, while the last took its place as Jason's shadow. Jason's tactical map and voice communication made sure everyone could be alerted the moment a threat appeared. Sophie was not a stealthy scout like Jason, but her mobility was incomparable. Whether running up the sides of buildings or sailing between them, she was the embodiment of agility and grace. Sometimes she would blast herself into the air with a short burst of wind and glide above them, using further bursts to throw herself higher. In this way, she could effectively fly, scouting ahead with the vantage that offered. She was also seemingly inexhaustible. Her celestine nature reduced the ongoing mana cost of powers, while her avatar of speed power reduced those costs even further. "She's really getting a handle of her powers," Jason said, looking up in admiration. "She's like a bird on the wing."
"They used to call her the Nightingale in the fighting pits," Belinda said. "If only they could see her now."
They had a soul compass that would point to the closest thing with a soul, except for themselves, who had been filtered out. That meant cultists or flesh abominations, which could very well be the same thing. It would not forewarn them of monsters, however. The team had already determined a policy of how to handle monster encounters. To begin with, they would fight anything they didn't recognize altogether, even if it was Iron Rank. Once they had an idea of what they were up against, they would start sending out their members who could best handle or best learn from any given encounter. The astral space's magical saturation promised monsters, which it quickly delivered. It was only 8 or so kilometers from one tower to the next, yet they had 2 monster encounters on the way. The first was a pair of bronze rank monsters that were quite tough, but no match for the team's rapidly growing capabilities. The next was a cluster of bark lurkers, a type of iron rank monster commonly seen in the Delta. It was normally a solitary creature, but here they encountered a half dozen, all at once. They were very hardy creatures and proved more difficult to deal with than the 2 bronze rank ones. They sat around on strewn moss-covered rubble, resting after the fight.
"Looks like we might be fighting altogether for a bit," Neil said. "Those extra numbers are rough."
"That's the magical saturation at work," Clive said. "The weaker the monster, the more of them we can expect to see."
"What about something that already travels in packs?" Neil said.
"Will there be a whole army of them?"
"Probably," Clive said.
"Jason fought a bark lurker during our field assessment," Humphrey said.
"Back then, my afflictions were the best way to handle them," Jason said. "Your special attacks seem to be doing just fine now."
"I envy those high damage attacks," Sophie said.
"I like your retaliation power," Humphrey told her. "You stopped that thing like it had run into a cliff face."
Bark lurkers were largely slow, but would make charging rush attacks. One of them tried to use it on Sophie, to unfortunate effect. Her balance essence ability, Moment of Oneness, could absorb attacks for a brief moment, then return their power back on an enemy. She had jammed her fingers into a gap between the thick carapace plates of the bark lurker and unleashed the full power of its own charge onto it.
"I'm not sure it was as harsh as you say," Humphrey told Neil.
"We will need to be pushed further than these fights did if we want to cross that line into bronze."
"Speak for yourself," Belinda said. "I found those plenty rough enough."
"I'm sorry," Humphrey said to her. "I know this will be harder on you than any of us. We all awakened our powers more slowly than you, and worked our way up through easier fights than you have, and will continue to face. All the more since your powers are a lot more sophisticated than a set like mine."
The others nodded. "You've had it harder than all of us," Jason said. "You went out on a road contract before you were even a member of the Adventure Society. It must be fairly overwhelming."
"It's been a lot of changes,"
Belinda acknowledged, then shared a look with Sophie, before turning her gaze back to the team.
We know what it's like to be running on a knife edge, though. At least now we're running towards something instead of away.
Between rough terrain and monster fights, it took the team hours to close the distance to the second tower. They reached the second tower, finding no more signs of cultist activity than the first. Clive, now that he knew what to look for, was able to find the hidden door quite quickly, revealing another enormous golem. The sun was descending over the city, and it was unlikely they would make the next tower before dark without picking up the pace. While the others remained at the base of the tower as Clive closed the door back up, Jason and Humphrey made their way to the top, looking out to the next tower.
"What do you think?" Humphrey asked. "Do we camp here or push it?"
"Neither," Jason said. "We shouldn't camp near the towers. The cultists probably don't know we're here, but let's not make it easy for them just in case. We pick somewhere more hidden and defensible between here and the next tower."
"All right," Humphrey agreed.
Jason set up his cloud house. As he had chosen the adaptive version, it took on the appearance of an overgrown stone building, blending perfectly into the surroundings. The next morning, Humphrey rousted the team not to press on immediately, but for the day's training routine. The training took up a solid chunk of the morning, going from physical training to movement training to combat training to mental training. They had brought along the set of weights Jason had inherited from Farah, which were simple but would serve them through bronze rank. "We're in a strange dimension full of monsters and treasure," Neil complained. "And I'm here doing arm curls."
"The best are the best because they don't slack off," Humphrey told him.
"Do I have to be the best?" Neil asked. "Couldn't I just be pretty good but with a sexy wife?" Sophie led the way with mobility training, the strange terrain actually making for a good training ground. Jason guided the team through meditation, aura training, and the mental exercises that Farah had taught to him. They kept up the slow but steady pace, monster after monster and tower after tower, with no sign of the cultists. They would check two or three new towers each day, depending on the terrain and how many monsters they encountered. Each tower seemed to have one of the huge golems inside. They couldn't travel for more than a few hours without encountering monsters. Of a night, they would retire to the Cloud House, a much more luxurious accommodation than what they had for the Reaper trials. That was only a limited respite, as each night some magically sensitive monster would find the house and attack it. What limited damage the monsters were able to do before the team emerged to handle the problem, the house would repair easily. It did mean Jason needed to replenish the magic expended to do so by dropping spirit coins into the cloud flask as if it were a slot machine. The raw magic of the coins was exactly what the house needed to reconstitute any damage. They were frugal with their supplies. They did not use crystal wash, instead showering off what were inevitably blood and gore-caked bodies in the cloud house showers every evening. Food was in short supply. The team had allocated the room in their personal storage spaces and dimensional bags for critical adventuring supplies. They sustained themselves on spirit coins. Jason hoarded his small stock of actual food to celebrate rank ups when they eventually came.
"At this point, it seems like they haven't set up around one of the towers," Humphrey said on their fourth night in the city, as the team was sitting in the lounge of the Cloud House.
"Where do we check next, then?" Neil asked. "The center of the city, where the last trials were?"
"It's as good a place as any," Humphrey said. "What can we expect to find there, Shade?" "The Trials Tower should be quite thoroughly destroyed by now," Shade said. "The magic maintaining the tower's integrity was withdrawn with the completion of the trials. Without control over the dimensional spaces within, they most likely devoured themselves and the bulk of the tower with them. There may be some things of value in what remains. It is possible that treasures unclaimed during the trials were not annihilated and could still be waiting to be excavated."
"Now we're talking," Neil said. "Hidden secrets, buried treasure, now that's an adventure."
The soul compass was not a flat object, but spherical, with the needle floating magically within. The needle moved on a central pivot point, like a regular compass, but could also indicate verticality. It moved slowly, suggesting that the closest soul was still some distance away.
I think it's safe to say that the cultists are deeper into the city, Clive said.
We'll still check the last two towers today, just in case, Humphrey said. Tomorrow we head for the center.
And the loot, Neil added. They had already encountered some treasure, three awakening stones they had picked up along the way. They hadn't been looking, but with so many enhanced magical senses on the team, they were easy to find by simple proximity. Although the flesh abominations and cultists remained distant, the monsters were still attacking with enthusiasm. The team was reminded that those were not the only threats the astral space had to offer when Sophie dropped lightly to the ground in front of them.
Vorgia, she warned. Lots of them. It was like a cloud bank moving in.
Jason used the lightness of his cloak and the leaping power of his magical boots to reach the top of a nearby building in a few easy jumps. He looked out at the incorporeal, ghost-like astral creatures bearing down on them as the team made preparations below. They drew closer and closer as he watched, until it was like a wall of whiteness moving through the sky. Jason's aura erupted out of him, like a tsunami, washing over the Vorgia. The astral beings were themselves like ragged scraps of soul, so he made a soul attack against them. There was a piercing shriek and a horrible tearing sound, and then the Vorgia were gone, as if they had never existed at all.
Chapter 37 Greenhouse Flowers. As they anticipated, they reached all 12 towers without encountering the cultists.
Shouldn't the pillars be central to what they're trying to achieve? Jason asked as the team stood atop the final tower.
Whether it's trying to sever the connection to the world or do something with the giant golems inside them, the towers should be key, right?
Yes, Clive said. Between their absence here and whatever they're doing to raise the magical density, I'm extremely concerned. Before we even came in here, we knew that none of the people on our potential cultist list had the kind of astral magic expertise that will be required to truly accomplish anything. There was always the question of how they were going to sever this astral space, but now it seems that there is more to the cult's scheme than we realized.
Before they left Greenstone, the backgrounds of the suspected cultists had been thoroughly investigated. They were all local, from lower-tier aristocracy or wealthy non-aristocrat families. Because the families involved didn't have the political clout to stop it, the Adventure Society had scoured the homes and investigated the relations of the suspects for any and all information they could find. Most of the families had no indication of cult activity, while others had already been exposed as cult sympathizers during the purge.
Our biggest point of confusion was that the people we're after simply don't have the skill set to accomplish the cult's goals as we understand them, Clive continued. Our best guess was that they brought something with them, some manner of artifact or device that could do what they needed. Now it seems that our ignorance of their objectives was even greater than we thought. We don't know if they still want to claim the astral space, awaken these constructs, or if it's something to do with the changes to the ambient magic.
Are you sure we shouldn't try destroying one of those constructs? Neil asked.
Very, Clive said. We wouldn't be able to anyway. Even Humphrey and Jason, who can overlook rank disparity in certain regards, wouldn't be able to damage them. All they would accomplish would be to trigger any defense mechanisms that might be in place. That's not even considering that the golems might, in some way, be essential to the core functions of the towers, which is to stabilize this astral space.
The astral space is going to become unstable anyway, though, isn't it? Jason asked. Won't an unnaturally high level of magical density eventually make the dimensional wall break down?
That's right, Clive said. If something is pushing through magic that's too high grade for the dimensional wall to endure, it will eventually break down. It'll take quite a while, by which I mean a decade or longer. But if whatever is causing the change isn't stopped, it will happen eventually. Even if it is stopped, if that happens too late, the damage will be done.
What would the effects of that be? Humphrey asked.
If the dimensional wall between the physical reality and this astral space breaks down, Clive said, then astral forces will pour in like a tide and wash everything away. This astral space will no longer exist.
What would the repercussions of that be for our world?
Humphrey asked.
Actually, that would be fine for our world, Clive said. The astral space would be washed off the side of our world like washing dirt off your arm.
That's not what the Builder wants, though, Jason said. He wants to take astral spaces, not destroy them. Especially, I would think, when they're loaded up with his property.
Hopefully the cultists have some answers, Humphrey said. If they aren't in the center of the city, we'll just have to start following the soul compass, clearing out the flesh abominations as we find them. Eventually, it will lead us to the cultists.
The team turned their monster-filled trek towards the interior of the city. For the first time, they experienced a rapid shift in the direction the soul compass was pointing. It signaled their proximity to what, unsurprisingly, turned out to be a flesh abomination. The abominations outnumbered the cultists by more than 50-1, and the cultists were almost certainly together. The abominations were solitary by nature, aggressively lashing out at any living thing they encountered. That left them scattered all around the city, compared to whatever rock the cultists were hiding under. Given that fighting the abominations was one of their explicit goals in returning to the astral space, they had given some consideration to how to do so. The abominations had two advantages: their ability to adapt and the power of an upper-tier bronze rank monster. The weaknesses the team sought to exploit were a lack of intelligence and the fact that, while it could adapt, it always remained a creature of living flesh. The first weakness, low intelligence, they hoped to exploit by confusing the monster's adaptations, alternating modes of attack to soak up time as it changed back and forth. To do this, the plan was to have Sophie and Humphrey repeatedly switch off against the monster, forcing it to adapt alternately to her speed and then to his power. The hope was that doing so would prevent a singular adaptation it could use to effectively fight the team. The purpose in stalling out the fight was to exploit the abomination's second weakness, the inability to overcome Jason's afflictions. They knew from fighting one previously that it would adapt to prevent itself from losing combat effectiveness, but that eventually there would be a threshold beyond which it could no longer sustain itself. The abomination was lairing in an old church, although not one of any god the team recognized. What little remained of the iconography was wholly unfamiliar, and they had little time to examine it before the abomination sensed their presence. They waited outside, where they could take advantage of the open space and have the bulk of the team at a safe remove. When the creature appeared, it was a large, blobby mass of pink and yellow flesh, ambling out onto the street on four stubby legs. The abomination's inactive state was its weakest, when it was slow and soft, which Jason took full advantage of. He opened with spells and then followed with special attacks, using his shadow arm to keep his distance. He laid on his afflictions with practiced efficiency as the abomination was already changing its form in response. As Jason danced around it, casting spells and reaching out with special attacks, the abomination grew tentacles all over its round body that ended in vicious claws. The result looked like a Lovecraftian echidna, the flexible limbs lashing to try and catch Jason wherever he went. By the time the creature truly got going, Jason's job was done, and he cleanly teleported away. Communicating through voice chat, Humphrey teleported in, directly taking his place. The quick and flexible limbs, useful for pinning down the elusive Jason, lacked the strength to dig through Humphrey's armor as he launched himself forward, burying his sword in the abomination's side. The creature reacted by growing thick, chitinous plates that would protect it, while the many limbs consolidated into fewer, larger, more powerful ones. These were also covered in chitin, resembling long, sharp praying mantis arms. The completion of its adaptation signaled Humphrey's departure as he teleported out again. In his place, Sophie rushed in like a storm to face the now sluggish, heavily plated creature. The creature swung its powerful limbs at her. They weren't slow, but it took more than not slow to catch Sophie. She deftly avoided them as she attacked the plated body with fists and feet. Her attacks were not as powerful as Humphrey's, but the resonating force power her abilities added to her unarmed strikes were able to penetrate the heavy armor.
It seemed like everything would go perfectly to plan, as Sophie and Humphrey switched off in rapid succession, forcing the monstrosity into continuous adaptation. It became evident it would not be quite so easy as it first seemed, however, when the abomination's adaptations became more and more refined. Slowly, it transmogrified into a lean, insect-like creature with strong plates but agile limbs, hard to catch and hard to hurt. It had two whip-like tendrils with segmented shards of razor-sharp chitin. They thrashed and danced, strong enough to hurt Humphrey, yet swift and unpredictable enough to catch Sophie. Neil threw out shields and healing from a safe distance, but the fight was slowly turning against them. The longer the fight went on, the closer the abomination came to finding the perfect combination of traits. The fight seemed on the verge of flipping against the team as the abomination continued to morph itself into the perfect weapon. Sophie and Humphrey were desperately fighting together as Clive and Belinda added their support. They had been holding off for the most dangerous moment, not wanting the abomination to have adapted when they came in at a critical point. Clive opened up with his powerful attack spell, then unleashed it a second and third time with Belinda's help, before she then copied it to use herself. Clive's spell was slow and difficult to use, but one of the advantages was it could attack in multiple ways. Ability, Wrath of the Magister, Magic, Spell, Fire, Magic, Curse, Poison, Wounding, Ice, Dimension. Cost, moderate mana, plus additional mana per effect. Cooldown, 1 minute. Current rank, Iron, 9, 61%. Effect, Iron. Lock a prismatic beam onto an enemy. Expend additional mana to alter the target's reality using any combination of the available color effects. This cannot be used in conjunction with the other variant of this spell, which requires an alternate incantation. Effect, Iron. Lock a prismatic beam onto an enemy. Expend additional mana to unmake reality in a localized area, creating an annihilating void sphere inside the target. This effect requires magic to be channeled into the target at an extreme mana cost until sufficient mana has been channeled to trigger the effect. Red, high mana. Target's temperature is significantly increased. Frostburn if combined with blue. Yellow, high mana. Target's abilities have increased mana cost. Pink, moderate mana. Target's resistances are reduced. Green, moderate mana. Target's blood is poisonous to itself. Purple, very high mana. Expending mana harms the target. Orange, very high mana. Target suffers increased damage from all sources. Blue, high mana. Target's temperature is significantly decreased. Frostburn if combined with red. Clive had various abilities that gave him a larger mana pool than most adventurers of his rank. Knowing that he would only be casting a few spells, he went all out. His first casting of the spell reduced the abomination's resistances, made its own blood poisonous, and made it take more damage from all sources. The second spell combined heat and cold into a potent frostburn effect, stronger than either individually. His third spell used the void sphere variation to devastating effect, Belinda following up immediately with a second one. The overwhelming barrage of magic pushed the abomination over the edge. The chitin was scored and cracked from the frostburn. Chunks were missing altogether, the annihilation sphere carving them out like scoops of ice cream. No longer able to hold back the afflictions, the creature collapsed on the ground, dark filth spilling out like a rotten egg that had been cracked open. The team had seen some graphic things in their time, but the miserable, rotting demise of the flesh creature was especially hard to watch. The stench that struck them after was even worse, a near match for the rainbow smoke of a monster dissolving. "It's hard to imagine that thing used to be a person," Neil said.
"It's about as bad an end as I can imagine," Clive said. "A prison of rage and madness built from your own twisted body. The only escape you can hope for is the release of death, yet you cannot die until someone brings about your violent demise."
"It's good that we're doing this," Sophie said. "I've had my share of bad situations, but nothing like this. I'm glad we can help them."
The rest of the team nodded their somber agreement.
"Thank you," Shade said. "Most of these abominations have been suffering for centuries."
"One down, a few hundred to go," Humphrey said.
We have a lot of work ahead of us.
The island city was a roughly circular 40 kilometers across. If not for the streets being overrun by monster-filled jungle, it would be a matter of hours to reach the center. During the trials, the teams had all taken their time, testing themselves against the environment and seeking out treasure, knowing they had the time to do so. Jason and his team took a more direct approach, but were careful. They could have taken hours if they pushed it, or teleported directly in. Clive, Jason, and Humphrey each could have taken them into the building they had rested in while awaiting the final stage of the trials, which would have been a relatively safe place to arrive. While hidden from the eyes of any cultists present, though, there would be no hiding the ostentatious magic of a portal opening from their magical senses. Given that the cultists were bronze rank now, they would have as many people with enhanced magic senses as Jason and his team. Their time in the astral space was increasingly an ordeal. Every day had been an endless slog of monsters, from the numerous to the powerful, and the team was rapidly becoming exhausted. One evening, as the team rested in the cloud house, Jason and Humphrey were sitting together on the roof. "At some stage, we'll need to stop for a rest day," Humphrey said.
"Just hide out in the cloud house and recover?"
Jason asked.
"Exactly," Humphrey said. "This ongoing pressure is good for our advancement, but I don't want to go past the point it stops driving us forward and starts dragging us down."
"I don't think we're there yet," Jason said. "These monsters are either bronze rank or a crowd of iron ranks, so it's been driving the team to rely on each other more. If we're ever going to have the kind of teamwork that Valdis's team has, we need that."
"I don't want to come into conflict with the cultists when the team is blunted from overuse," Humphrey said. "I want to meet them while we're a freshly sharpened knife. Does that mean refreshed from a well-earned rest, though, or in a strong rhythm on the back of a series of successful monster fights?"
"Ask Neil," Jason said. "He's our healer, and he does his job well. He pays more attention to the condition of the team than anyone."
Humphrey nodded. "You're right," he said. "One of the last pieces of advice my mother gave me before we left was to rely on the team. She said I shouldn't fall into the trap of trying to do everything myself. I suppose that isn't just restricted to combat, is it?"
"No," Jason said. "It's a trap we could both easily fall into. I've learned the hard way that I'm not always as clever and insightful as I think I am."
He let out a sigh, heavy with regret.
"I've been thinking about Thadwick a lot," Jason said. "I've come to realize that he and I are very similar."
"Really?"
"Yes," Jason said. "We share the same flaws, arrogance, vanity, being self-impressed, and having a need to show off. The real difference between us is that I've had people to slap some sense into me, where the people around him just reinforce the idea that he was special. His mother was off adventuring for most of his life, and his father was grooming him as heir. His head was filled with how great and important he was going to be, without tempering it with humility. He never had the sense of responsibility your mother drilled into you, or the friends that pull me back into line when I go too far off the rails."
"I suppose I can see it," Humphrey said. "Perhaps Thadwick saw it too. Maybe that's why he was so fixated on you."
"That makes sense," Jason said. "I eventually realized that the reason I took such a dislike to Thadwick is that but for sycophancy, there goes I."
"Things have worked out for you a lot better than they have for Thadwick," Humphrey said.
"Thadwick is what we call a greenhouse flower in my world," Jason said. "Outside of the specific environment in which he was raised, he withers. He was never taught to withstand rough weather."
"I had some of that too," Humphrey said. "I think my mother regrets how much she shielded me from."
"I'm the same," Jason said. "My homeland is much safer than this world. My family has money, not like yours, but enough to live better than most. For you and me, though, there was always someone who recognized that we would have to make our own way sooner or later. They prepared us for that. For Thadwick, his parents always intended to make his way for him, and he paid the price of that."
"You still feel sorry for him, after all that he's done?" Humphrey said. "Trying to kill you, running off to the Builder cult?"
"I do," Jason said.
"Do you think there's a path to redemption for him?"
"No," Jason said. "He's gone too far, done too much.
His choices have hurt too many. There's no way back for him now.
Chapter 38. A Man Transformed. The team congratulated Jason as another of his abilities reached bronze rank during his evening meditation. As they were all perpetually using the party interface, they had shared the notification. Ability, Blade of Doom. Doom has reached Iron 9, 100%. Ability, Blade of Doom. Doom has reached Bronze 0, 00%. Ability, Blade of Doom. Doom has gained a new effect. Ability, Blade of Doom. Doom has gained the Curse, Disease, and Poison subtypes. Ability, Blade of Doom. Doom. Conjuration, Unholy, Curse, Disease, Poison. Cost, Moderate Mana. Cooldown, None. Current rank, Bronze, 0, 00%. Effect, Iron. Conjures Ruin, the Blade of Tribulation. Attacks made with Ruin will inflict an instance of Vulnerable and refresh any wounding effects on the target. Wounding effects refreshed by Ruin require more healing than normal to negate. Ruin is an unholy object. Effect, Bronze. Ruin inflicts one instance each of Ruination of the Blood, Ruination of the Flesh, and Ruination of the Spirit. Vulnerable, Affliction, Unholy, Stacking. All resistances are reduced. Additional instances have a cumulative effect. Consumed to cleanse instances of Resistant on a one-to-one basis. Ruination of the Blood. Damage over time. Poison, Stacking. Inflicts ongoing necrotic damage until poison is cleansed. Additional instances have a cumulative effect. Ruination of the Flesh. Damage over time. Disease, Stacking. Inflicts ongoing necrotic damage until disease is cleansed. Additional instances have a cumulative effect. Ruination of the Spirit. Damage over time. Curse, Stacking. Inflicts ongoing necrotic damage until curse is cleansed. Additional instances have a cumulative effect.
That's a strong boost to your short-term damage output, Clive said. It's not the same as a direct damage power, but for weaker enemies, a quick handful of damaging afflictions will let you spread a lot of misery in not a lot of time.
That will help you a lot against groups, Humphrey agreed. That's always been an issue for you because it took more time than it was worth to layer afflictions. Now you can put, what, 4 damage afflictions with a simple cut from your dagger?
It's probably for the best you're not evil, Neil said.
You're not evil, right?
No, I'm not evil, Jason said.
Because you seem evil with your powers.
Well, I'm not.
That's good to know, Neil said. Thankfully, someone evil wouldn't lie about that.
Oh, wait. You realize who is at the top of my list if I really am evil, right?
Jason asked.
The guy who bought out the cheesemonger on Maple Street and replaced it with a building supply store?
Neil suggested.
Oh, yeah. I hate that guy.
Clive was standing atop a broken spire as monsters swarmed towards it like a river. They were akin to apes, but leaner and with longer legs. They approached the tower on which he stood with a quick, semi-quadrupedal lope. Clive was standing on what had once been the interior of a tower top, now exposed on all sides with the walls and roof long gone. Under his feet, the floor glowed with ritual circles drawn by his power in lines of golden light. It was the result of the bronze rank variant of his strong attack spell.
Ability, Wrath of the Magister. Magic. Spell, Ritual. Fire, Magic. Curse, Poison. Wounding, Ice. Dimension. Cost, Varies. Cooldown, Varies. Current rank, Bronze, 0, 00%. Effect, Bronze. Create a ritual circle in which the magical attacks of spells, staves, and wands have increased effect. This effect has a very high mana cost and a 1-hour cooldown.
Rather than enhancing what was already a potent and versatile attack spell, the bronze rank variant offered another means to enhance combat effectiveness. Clive was wielding one of his 2 legendary set weapons, the wand and the staff, in each hand.
At the end of each were more ritual circles, floating in the air like magical barrel attachments.
Ability: Tools of the Magister, Magic. Special ability: Ritual. Cost: Varies. Cooldown: None. Current rank: Bronze, 0.00%. Effect: Iron. Utilize specialty magic tools, vehicles, and weapons. Effect: Bronze. Use a ritual circle to enhance the magical effect of a staff or wand. This variant requires high mana.
Clive unleashed bolts from his staff that hurtled into the approaching monsters. He wasn't even really aiming as he essentially hip-fired the staff, gripping it in one hand and tucked into his armpit. Whether the bolts hit the ground or a monster, the results were explosive, throwing out splinters of wood and stone from the overgrown environment, or chunks of aggressively discorporated monster. In his other hand, his wand emitted a continuous beam that he worked back and forth through the monsters with little more accuracy than the staff. Normally, the wand required continual focus to be deadly, but the enhanced beam sliced through the monsters in a sweeping line, lopping off limbs or killing outright. Through a far-seeing crystal, Jason and the rest of the team watched. To Jason's eyes, Clive had turned the broken spire into a sci-fi beam tower from an RTS. The monsters were undeterred by their losses, however, and continued their Zerg rush at Clive's position.
"I can see why he had you bait them now," Jason said to Sophie. She was freshly returned from luring the monsters in Clive's direction.
"He's making a mess, but he's rather imprecise," Humphrey observed. "They'll start climbing that tower any moment."
"I imagine that's what his backup is for," Belinda said.
Just as Humphrey said, the monsters reached the tower and started to climb, an assault for which the ape-like creatures were well suited. As they did, a large round figure floated slowly through the air from behind the tower. Clive's familiar, Onslow, drifted ponderously into view, suspended in the sky on a cushion of shimmering air. Now bronze rank, he was roughly the size and shape of a Volkswagen Beetle, with more runes engraved into his shell than ever before. The rune tortoise started blasting the creatures, climbing up with elemental attacks, sourced from the runes on his shell. An explosive bolt of flame blasted several off at once, while a bolt of lightning chained from one to another, sending them screaming off the side. A dark, heavy cloud rose up from Onslow's shell, growing larger than the tortoise itself, and peppered the side of the tower with water bullets. They weren't very lethal, even to the iron rank monsters, but did serve to dislodge them while also leaving the stone of the tower wet and harder to climb. Clive continued blasting away at the main force of the monsters, which was rapidly thinning out as Onslow continued to pick off the stragglers. There was a brief pause as Onslow floated up to Clive. He used his own mana to recharge the runes on Onslow's shell before the pair returned to action. Even though most of their number were cut down before even reaching the tower, the monsters continued, unabated. The team, watching from a distance, had been poised to jump in at any time. When Clive told them he wanted to face the horde alone, they were wary but accepting. Now they just looked on in amazement at the pyrotechnic display as the monsters charged into a futile death.
"Well, damn," Sophie said.
"Won't all this get a lot of attention?" Neil asked.
"Probably," Humphrey said.
"Anything with even a modicum of sense will take one look at this and run in the other direction, though."
In amongst the several dozen iron rank monsters were two larger bronze rank variants. Clive seemed to ignore them as they reached the spire and started rapidly climbing. Onslow didn't react either, other than to float further away from the tower. As the first one reached the top, Clive used his switch teleport power.
Ability: Juxtapose, Balance. Special ability: Cost, High Mana. Cooldown: 1 minute. Current rank: Bronze, 0.00%. Effect: Iron. Swap the location of two allies and or enemies. You must be able to see both subjects of the spell. If an ally resists or otherwise prevents the effect, this ability is negated, but the cooldown is reduced to 30 seconds. Effect: Bronze. Enemies affected by this ability take additional damage from all sources for a brief period.
The monster vanished, with Onslow appearing in its place. Now, in the air where Onslow had been, the monster fell, wildly flailing its limbs. It landed hard, right on one of Clive's invisible rune traps. The trap triggered, sending the monster, or at least the parts that used to be a monster, back into the air and scattering them over the battlefield. A few moments later, smaller explosions rang out where the larger chunks of monster had fallen. Ability, rune trap, rune, spell, cost, high mana, cooldown, 1 minute, current rank, bronze, 0.00%, effect, iron. Create an explosive rune that will disappear after a short period. The rune can be set to trigger by proximity, caster trigger, or both. Effect, bronze. Enemies affected by the rune trap will be the source of a secondary explosion after a brief period. The second monster crested the tower and launched a huge fist at Clive. The air around the ape-like creature's fist shimmered, much like the cushion holding up Onslow. The fist crashed on Clive like a hammer and struck the shield around Clive, which briefly became visible as it sucked up Clive's mana to withstand the blow. Clive shoved his wand between his teeth, and his now empty hand turned mirror silver. The air around it shimmered, just as the monster's had, and he rammed his fist into the hairy monster's torso. Despite the lanky man punching a monster at least 3 times his weight, the monster went sailing off the spire. Clive quickly aimed and blasted out a shot from his staff, hitting the monster in mid-air. The red of life force emerged from Clive's body, a tendril snaking out and into the rune circle that was floating at the edge of his staff. The golden lines of the ritual circle transformed into an angry, bloody crimson. Ability, blood magic, balance, special ability. Cost, varies, cooldown, none. Current rank, bronze, 0.00%. Effect, iron. Consume an amount of your own life force to replenish your mana. Effect, bronze. Consume an amount of your life force to enhance the effect of an active ritual. The next blast that emerged from the staff was much larger than those that had come before. The energy bolt hit the monster at the same time the monster hit the ground. It did not get up. By this point, the iron rank monsters were a scattered remnant of the original horde, but the wildly aggressive creatures kept rampaging forward in the face of inevitable destruction. When the last of them were dead, Clive hopped lightly onto Onslow's shell, sitting cross-legged as the tortoise floated back to the team. The familiar's new flight ability was much faster when hovering close to the ground, so Onslow dropped low and floated just over the bodies of the dead monsters as they returned to the team. Clive arrived at the ruined building, where the team had been watching from safety. He lightly slid down Onslow's shell, wand held casually in one hand and staff slung over one shoulder.
"You know," he told the waiting team, "I'm starting to think I might not be too bad at this."
The night before they expected to reach the center of the city, the team was doing their evening meditation. Jason led Neil, Sophie, Belinda, and Humphrey in the Dance of the Sword Fairy, a meditation technique that incorporated dance-like physical movements using a sword as a focus. It was something that Rufus had taught him and had proven one of the more successful techniques for Sophie. Clive was outside, having made preparations for his anticipated ascension to bronze. He had set aside a space for the messy transition, picking a spot inside some ruins near the cloud house. He had stripped down to his underwear and placed fresh clothes where he could reach them later. Close to hand was one of Jason's precious few bottles of undiluted crystal wash. Clive was settled into some soft moss, meditating.
"No, Onslow, don't eat the moss. That's my seat."
Clive called Onslow back into the tattoo on his torso before resuming meditation. When he crossed the final threshold, the rest of the team knew immediately.
Ability, Vengeance Mirror, Karmic, has reached Iron 9, 100%. Ability, Vengeance Mirror, Karmic, has reached Bronze 0, 0.00%. Ability, Vengeance Mirror, Karmic, has gained a new effect. Ability, Vengeance Mirror, Karmic. Special ability, cost, varies, cooldown, none. Current rank, bronze, 0.00%. Effect,
iron. Replicate the last spell or special attack used on you by an enemy. Mana cost is determined by the ability replicated. You may still use this ability if the triggering effect was negated by your abilities, but not if it was negated by the abilities of an ally. The replicated power functions at the rank of this ability, not the rank of the enemy that originally used it. Effect, bronze, use the replicated ability a second time.
That was just the beginning of a strenuous series of changes.
All karmic essence abilities have reached bronze, 0. Linked attribute, power, has increased from iron, 9, to bronze, 0. Progress to bronze rank, 100%, 4 of 4 essences complete.
Amber light started shining from within Clive's body. He felt pressure build up inside him like a balloon inflated towards the point of bursting. The team rushed outside but didn't intrude on his secluded area in the ruins. They stood back and watched the amber light shine from within.
All your attributes have reached bronze rank. You have reached bronze rank. You have gained resistance to iron rank and lower damage sources and effects. The potency of your aura has increased. Your aura senses have improved. Progress to silver rank, 0%.
Oh, this feels amazing, Clive said through voice chat. I'm just waiting for the... Oh, there it is.
The sounds coming from Clive's secluded spot were bad, but nothing compared to the smell. The coughing, spluttering vomit noises were matched by a stench they had all experienced before on reaching iron rank, when their bodies had purged and renewed all the biomass it would immediately replace.
I wish I hadn't just got my spirit attribute to bronze, Neil winced, holding his nose. The improved senses are not appreciated right now.
You should take this as a training opportunity, Humphrey said. There are monsters that will use stench against you, so you should adjust now.
Tell me that again when you're smelling thus with a bronze rank sense of smell, and maybe I'll listen.
The noises stopped. All they could hear was heavy, exhausted breathing.
You still conscious in there, mate? Jason called out.
Yes, Clive said wearily.
He used voice chat again, rather than expend the effort to yell out.
Give me a moment to clean up. I suspect that once I've gotten away from the smell, I'm going to be very hungry.
No worries, Jason said. I'm just going to move the cloud house upwind a bit, and then I'll set out a feast for a king. A small king, though. We only had so much space.
Clive arrived at the slightly relocated cloud house, crystal washed clean and with a fresh set of clothes. He was a man, literally transformed. The awkward, lanky frame and hapless, bookish features were gone. In their place was a tall and lean figure with an easy grace to his step and effortlessly appealing facial features.
You're the scientist no one listens to at the start of a disaster movie, Jason said. Except now you're at the end of the movie when you've lost your glasses, your hair is attractively tousled, you've found the heroism within, and realized your implausibly attractive lab assistant was pining for you the whole time.
I'm not even going to try and follow that, Clive said. I'll just assume it's a compliment and say thank you.
Also, I'm not pining, Belinda said. I did like the unrealistically attractive part, though.
You should try finding a man you like when Sophie's standing next to you. Thank the gods Jory has depth of character.
Are you suggesting people are only interested in my looks? Sophie asked.
Of course I'm saying that, Belinda said. You're like a treasure chest full of swords with no handles. It looks enticing, but rummaging about inside is going to get you hurt.
Thank you, Sophie said brightly.
That was not a compliment.
How is that not a compliment? Sophie asked. Who doesn't want to be full of swords?
Can we just move on to the food?
Clive asked. Chapter 39. The Worst Possible Option. With a fully fledged bronze ranker in their number, the team felt more secure as they made their way to the city's interior. They progressed more swiftly than any of them had during the Reaper trials, for two main reasons. The first was confidence.
Rather than being scattered across the city and forced into makeshift teams, they had entered the astral space with allies they knew and could rely on. Even a powerful ally like Valdis was no substitute for a true comrade when life and death were on the line. The second reason was that they weren't scouring the place for treasures, although treasures they still found. In spite of the people that had flooded the astral space during the trials, the team still stumbled over a small fortune in awakening stones, essences, and other goods. In an old training hall, they found an adept essence and a whole rack of bronze rank magic weapons. None were exceptional, but they were valuable, nonetheless. In a library, they found a knowledge essence, plus some skill books whose magic had kept them intact, despite the hot, humid air. The normal books had long ago rotted away, making the skill books easy to pick out. The central region of the city had been clearly demarked into two areas during the trials. The very core of the city was its most intact region. The jungle had been prevented from reclaiming it by means unknown. In direct opposition to this, the area that ringed the centermost region was the most heavily reclaimed by jungle, as if all the growth not happening at the center were somehow piling up around it. The buildings there were little more than rubble, and much of the ruins had been entirely engulfed by foliage and vines. This ring of thick overgrowth had been the location of the giant carnivorous plant that occupied a staggering amount of space underground. It had been almost entirely annihilated through the efforts of Jason and a large force of adventurers. Only a few dead remnants of the plant monster had remained after it had been annihilated by the transcendent damage of Jason's execute power. His afflictions had never escalated to such a grand scale before, and he considered it unlikely that they ever would again. Creatures the size of a small city weren't easy to come by, and he'd rather avoid fighting any more. The team paused as they reached the ring of thick jungle. "You don't suppose it's grown back, do you?" Neil asked.
"It has not,"
Shade said, his voice coming from Jason's shadow.
"Whatever opinion one might have of Mr. Asano's abilities, a lack of thoroughness in their lethality is not a criticism likely to be leveled against them. I can assure you that the blood root vine was quite thoroughly destroyed."
"We need to be careful, going through this section of jungle," Humphrey said. "The jungle looks thicker than where I crossed over. From the looks of it, we'll have to cut our way through in places. It'll make for slow going, and scouting won't be easy."
"There's little point watching from above," Sophie said. "The canopy is too thick. I could track you by your auras, but I don't know how useful that would be."
"I don't think the risk of showing our auras off like that is worth it. We should keep our auras as retracted as we can," Humphrey said. "We should all stay close until we're through."
"Should we look for a place where the growth isn't so heavy?" Sophie asked. "This is definitely thicker than where we went through last time." "The growth of this area seems to have rapidly expanded in the absence of the bloodroot vine," Shade said. "At the time of the trials, none of the city had jungle this dense. It stands to reason that the rest of the central ring would have experienced similar growth during our absence."
"Should we reconsider teleporting through?" Neil asked. "It's not the worst idea in the world," Jason said. "Now that I'm looking at this jungle, I don't fancy hacking our way through. Not when the local monsters are stronger than ever, and you can bet that any manifesting in there will make better use of the environment than we do." Humphrey looked into the dense foliage as he considered.
"What does everyone else think?" he asked.
"I'm a city girl," Belinda said. "If we can skip trudging through all that, then I'm for it."
"It's a simple question of risk assessment," Clive said. "Is going through monster-infested jungle more dangerous than teleporting into what is potentially the very midst of the cultists? Given that we should be able to teleport into an area of relative safety, I would say teleporting is the superior option."
"And if they sense the magic of us all teleporting in?"
Sophie asked. "Then we fight," Humphrey said. "We're going there for that fight in any case. That said, I would rather initiate it on our own terms."
"Looks like we have a consensus," Clive said.
I'll open a portal to the roof of the building we stayed in before the final trials.
Clive held out a hand and a circle of runes appeared, alternating blue and gold. Normally, they would then fill with shimmering air and a blurred image of the destination. But instead, the runes simply blinked out, like someone had pulled the plug on them.
That's odd, Clive said.
Could portals be somehow impeded here? Belinda asked.
That should not be the case, Shade said, emerging from Jason's shadow. That being said, this space has undergone many changes in the months since my tenure here. We have made a number of disconcerting revelations, of which I was unaware, so my knowledge of this realm is not as reliable as I believed. If there is some manner of impedance on portals, I believe your power, Mr. Asano, has the best chance of retaining functionality. It is the basis for the portals incorporated into this place, after all.
Jason tried his portal ability, but had no more success than Clive. The obsidian arch appeared, but the shadow gate did not fill with the darkness. Instead, it retreated without activating. Humphrey tried to teleport them, but likewise achieved nothing.
My short-range teleport works fine, Humphrey said, vanishing and reappearing close by to prove his point.
Jason, you haven't had any issues shadow jumping, right?
It's been working just fine, Jason said.
These results suggest one of three possibilities, Clive said. One, as Belinda posited, is some manner of environmental interference. We know that the portals to leave this astral space are currently non-functional. My best guess is that it's related to the changes in the ambient magic and may be affecting our portal abilities in the same way.
That makes sense, Humphrey said.
The other possibilities, Clive continued, are the usual reasons that portal abilities fail. As we all know, a portal destination must be somewhere the person with the portal ability has visited in the past. They must also be able to clearly visualize that space, however. If the space is too generic to be memorable, or if time and failing memory warp the recollection, it won't work.
That's why big cities have portal stations, Humphrey said. They make them memorable, visually striking places, so that they are easy to remember from only a single visit.
That makes sense, Jason said. When I was finding waypoints across the desert to portal to for when I travelled to Skyscar Lake, I had to find landmarks that stood out. I don't think I could portal to a random patch of desert just because I happened to have passed through one time.
I remember that place quite well, though, Humphrey said. I remember the view from the rooftop very vividly. The square full of adventurers, the huge trial tower.
Which brings us to the third possibility, why the portals failed, Clive said. If the destination has significantly changed, then the visualization will be wrong and the portal will fail. It's not enough to redecorate a room, but if you demolish the building the room is in.
Shade, you said the tower has most likely been destroyed already, Jason said.
That is correct, Shade answered. The dimensional spaces within will likely have collapsed to destructive effect.
It could be that the destruction was widespread enough that our building was badly damaged, Humphrey said.
It's only a few kilometers, right? Belinda said. Sophie, couldn't you air jump your way up high enough to check?
Does it really matter what is causing it? Sophie asked. Whether the magic has gone weird or the building was knocked down, we can't do anything about either.
You're right, Humphrey agreed. Whatever the reason, portals can't get us where we want to go. We can do some testing later, but for now we have to make our way through this jungle. Shade, can we rely on you to do the scouting for us?
Of course, Mr. Geller. It would be my pleasure to contribute.
The rough terrain was more than just thick jungle. The ground was wildly uneven, from overgrown piles of rubble to areas where the ground had collapsed into deep holes. The team followed the path of least resistance as best they could, relying on Jason's map to keep them headed in roughly the right direction. Sometimes it was just too rough, forcing Humphrey to hack their way through the undergrowth with his sword.
These holes look relatively recent, Clive observed. I suspect there may be significant